This episode is made possible by Awin. Two-thirds of digital ad spend currently flows to the three big tech platforms, Google, Meta, and Amazon. But their auction-based ad models favor their own bottom line and inflate costs at a time when every single marketing dollar counts. Awin's affiliate partnerships platform offers a real alternative to big tech and puts you back in control of your ad spend. Want to find out how? Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that has a real-life Grinch on today's show, but he mainly goes by his given name of Oscar. Well, Oscar, what did you say before we hit record? All dogs are pointless and they shouldn't be allowed near people?
That's a lie. That
may or may not be a direct quote. Right. When Oscar watched 101 Dalmatians, he was rooting for Cruella de Vil. That is true. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Is it too early to talk about Generation Alpha?
A brand would be silly not to worry about them and what type of images or what do they react to or how are they inspired? Because they are going to their parents and saying, obviously they don't have money, so they're not buying it directly, right? But they are asking for things.
Delivery without the box.
I mean, ethically, I can understand it as well. Although I would argue, aren't we recycling those boxes? Aren't they being used again? Isn't that the point of them?
What is happening on TikTok Live?
Some of like this odd behavior that we're seeing on live streaming is definitely, it's not, you know, new to social media. People have been doing weird stuff on streams on Twitch and YouTube for a while.
Fast fashion looks to repairs, the future of website design, and what are the most popular amusement or theme parks in the world? Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with one of our vice presidents of content, also heads up our retail and e-commerce team based out of New York. It's Susie David Canyon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, Susie. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts on that very retail and e-commerce team, also based out of New York. It's Blake Drosch.
Hello, everyone.
And finally, we have with us one of our directors of forecasting, also based out of New York, all three of them. It is the Grinch. We also call him Oscar Roscoe.
Here I am. Hello, everybody.
What's up, fella? Victoria, if you could get some Grinch music in, that would be perfect.
I'm already Googling.
Yeah, I knew it should be.
Oh, no, you're a mean one.
Can't wait to hear this.
Mr. Grinch. What do we have in store for you? Well, story of the week is where we begin. Then there's a game and then some trivia at the end. Let's just get to it. We start with the story of the week. Is it too early to talk about Generation Alpha? That could be a statement or a question. An article by Davina Ajana of Getty Images Creative Insights does a nice job of introducing us to the generation, Generation Alpha that is. She writes that this is the first generation to be born entirely in the 21st century. Between 2010 and 2025, they will make up 1 in 7 people in the world, outnumber boomers by 2025, which is in 2 years, and start reaching adulthood by 2030, which is in just 7 years. A recent article in PR Newswire writes, "Move over, millennials and Gen Z. It's time to make space for Generation Alpha." It notes that they are kids of millennials starting to turn 13, they say in this. Depends on what range you're talking about, but it's somewhere in that range of like, some people say 9, 10, 11, 12 and below, basically. But they're starting to turn 13, this article notes, and still being born and will be the largest generation ever with the biggest spending power. A generation that will not know a world without AI, gaming, AR and streaming. But folks, is it time to make space already for Generation Alpha?
I don't think it's ever too early, right? Brands need to really understand who the up-and-coming consumers are so that they can get ready to welcome them into their space. Plus, to be honest, we know from a lot of different research that kids influence households, right? So understanding who the kids in the household are to try and get their attention is also a win.
Right. Because even if you're not selling directly to kids, just to kids, they are already starting to influence household purchases. And there was some Morning Consult research saying that a child's influence on household purchases starts from around the age of 5. And so they were saying for 5 to 9 year olds, 85% of their parents said that their kids had asked for products seen in stores, and Generation Alpha being, yeah, the top end of that 0 to 10 range.
So I don't think that's new. I don't think it's new. I don't know what the 85% is for when Gen Z was that age range or when millennials or X. I don't know what the percentage is. It's too bad they didn't have it for us. But it's definitely not new. Just think about all the images you see of parents with a kid or guardians, someone with a kid at a grocery store, and they're like, oh, can we have this cereal? And oh, can we have these chips?
Yeah.
Like, it is not a new phenomenon.
No, it's probably similar across generations. It's interesting just to see, like, at what age do they really start having real influence? But I think you're right, Susie. It's probably been a similar age going back however many generations.
And if it's not new, then why are we focusing so much on that? For example, as a Gen Alpha type of, you know, personalized Gen Alpha thing, right? And that's what I was going to get to at the beginning, Mark, is I think I kind of disagree a little bit here. You know, I'm not saying to completely ignore Alpha, but it's about something you said at the beginning, which was, well, we're kind of not sure how to define them yet. They might be 9 to 13. And I think that's one of the main problems at the moment, that it's not very clearly defined. Gen Z goes out to 2012 as the youngest Gen Z. So what we're saying is anyone that's an Alpha at the oldest would be 10 years old right now, and much younger. So if we are thinking as marketers here, why don't we focus on maybe millennials as parents, which we have a lot of research on, right? And we can do. So my issue with alphas is that they are still very young, and we're not quite sure what alphas are yet.
But it's an incomplete cohort, right? In that it is defined. It's anybody who was born after 2013, right? And so obviously it'll just keep going and it'll grow. And I actually think that there is some true differences between Gen Alpha and the others, which is, I didn't even occur to me. And I think about my brother's kids. One of them is in this generation pool-ish, on the cusp. His social network is not Instagram, or assuming that he was allowed to be on those platforms, but it's gaming. He's allowed to be on Roblox, and that's where they're making, I hope he's not, but I feel like that's where kids are learning things and meeting people and talking about trends, and maybe not at 5 years old, but they're on it, right? I think that's probably one of the biggest defining things.
Yeah, that was one of the observations from some of the research we looked at. Gaming becoming the new social network, and they're using it to express creativity more than socializing. The article was saying Gen Z are content creators, Gen Alpha are becoming world builders because they're on platforms that cater to that: Fortnite, Discord, Roblox.
Yeah, I think that's a little ridiculous. I kind of agree. I agree with both.
Thank you, Blake.
With Susie and Oscar, and like with Susie's right about, like, yes, it's never too early to start paying attention to sort of what this behavior is. But at the same time, like, I agree with Oscar in the sense that, A, like, yeah, they're using these gaming platforms because, as Susie mentioned, like, they're not allowed to be on other social networks. I'm sure, you know, there's an interest, but a lot of parents are now preventing, you know, younger children from being on these platforms. And the whole thing about them being world builders because they play video games is like one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. Like, if you go back to, you know, my childhood and the toys and the things that I played with, like, I'm thinking about like Tamagotchis and like, you know, the Fergie toy, like, and the like Poochie, like the robot dog, like, all those are the things that I was engaging with as like an 8 to 10 year old. So if you were to extrapolate, then you would say, oh, well, that generation is going to be best friends with robots, and I'm not friends with any robots. That's like the same thing. That's the same comparison as saying they're going to be world builders because they play Roblox instead of, you know, creating content on social media. It's just a weird extrapolation.
I just think that we're being too literal about the world builder, although I agree.
But that's what they're saying.
Yeah, it's a bit of a silly thing. What I think is also very different from the other generations, which we haven't talked about, is that this is a generation that is Web3 based, right? Like, I'm obviously not saying metaverse on purpose. The Web3 based, where it's not a linear space anymore, the web. It's interactive, and it's more and more information is at their fingertips in a more responsive sort of interactive dynamic way that they can see themselves in,
yeah,
which is different.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just I think what we should focus on are facts, like realities. And so I appreciate that type of research. I think one of the articles you sent was great research, as always, from Morning Consult. But they talked about things that are facts, which are they're more digitally inclined. It was accelerated because of the pandemic. They're the generation with the younger people, you know, using mobile devices more frequently at an earlier age, things mm-hmm. like this. That's true, right? They're tech savvy. But, you know, the comments like being world builders, or that they're more sensitive, or more, you know, they're more in tune with their mental health, things like this. I think it's a little early to say that. And so that's the distinction I think we should make there.
But that's research. That's like persona building research, right? I think what's harder for this young age, it's that the parents are being surveyed. So it's the parents' impression that this is what's going to happen mm-hmm. versus when you take the 16 plus year olds that are allowed to be surveyed directly. So in that way, yes, maybe it's a little bit extra, but that's how personas are built. That's how they decide if you're a value-driven shopper and you're going out for the deal, or if you prefer gamification. Technically, it's valid research.
Mm-hmm. I just think that it's too early and they're not even teenagers yet. So, you know, yes, we can, I understand the persona-driven research bit, but, you know, I think we need to maybe wait a few more years, not just to, because how we're defining it is some of these alphas are not even born yet. They're supposed to go be born out to 2025. Yeah. So maybe we should wait a few more years, see how they develop as independent mm-hmm. thinkers, and you know, maybe wait until they're at least teenagers.
Yeah, I'd love to look at like some of the research from, you know, if we could go back 10 years and see what people were saying about Gen Z and be like, okay, well, how right were they about, you know, these really, really early insights? Because like, yeah, maybe there's some kernels of truth, but like a lot of it is just, you know, okay, well, these are 8 to 10 year olds and they're not like fully formed by any means. So their habits and personality traits, you know, can and will change over time, because, you know, a lot of this research is based on, you know, what is the world that they're growing up in? But we don't really know the world that they're going to be growing up in, because they're only half grown at this point.
Yeah. But I would say that if you don't understand who they are today, we're not talking about their future state. We're talking about them today. And mm-hmm. we know that this particular generation has information at their fingertip earlier and earlier, and is part of the decision-making process in some way, shape, or form, then a brand would be silly not to worry about them and what type of images, or what do they react to, or how are they inspired? Because they are going to their parents and saying, obviously they don't have money, so they're not buying it directly, right? But they are asking for things. So a brand who is trying to get them and that doesn't understand them today is going to lose.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to release a line of Napoleon action figures, because they're all world builders. So if these theories are correct, then this should be the hottest selling toy for the holiday season 2023.
Guys, you're being too literal.
The two biggest questions.
When
should you pay most attention to these guys? When's the right time to pay a decent amount of attention to this generation? And then how are they going to be different from other generations, just the way we've seen with previous ones? What is interesting, I think, is that quite soon, I mean, Susie, to your point, like you want to pay some attention, because if you're paying no attention, before you know it, blink, and they could be part of the labor force quite quickly. And there was some study from McCrindle Research looking at the labor force by 2030. So in 7 years, Gen Z and Gen Alpha will account for nearly half of the labor force. Now, most of that is Gen Z, admittedly, but Gen Alpha will account for about 11%, and obviously will be growing quite quickly. And that's just in 2030. That's what we've got time for the story of the week. Time for the game of the week. Today's game, the hell is the point? Right, read out 4 stories, and Susie, Blake, and Oscar give us their main takeaways. Okay answers equal 1 point, good answers equal 2, and answers that give you the same feeling.
I'm saving $400 on a flight.
No, not that.
Oof, that's a good one.
How much time did you spend?
That would give you a good one.
See, that was a good one.
But how long did it take you?
Inconsequential.
Okay, that means too long.
No, well, if you're watching TV and surfing to look for a better price, does that count as time spent?
I don't know,
spent?
Oscar, what you're the time
spent
expert.
A little bit more efficient than that. I don't think that's efficient enough. You got to focus on it solely.
See, Marcus, then I would say 3 hours max. Big max.
Yeah,
big,
then it'd be
big
worth it.
You said you spent two weeks doing this.
I don't know about that.
I mean, but I was watching TV.
How many sites did you go to? I rest my case.
Maybe less than 10, honestly.
Okay. If you're near double figures, it's a problem. Answers that give you the same feeling as mint choc chip. Yeah?
Nausea?
No.
Yuck.
Yeah. This is some blasphemy happening.
You know what?
Right
I love mint chocolate chip. I love it.
Say that again.
This is some blasphemy happening right now.
Thank you. Exactly.
Have you ever had an Oreo thin mint flavor? Gross. It's delightful.
Oh, thank God, Victoria.
Sounds horrible.
Thank goodness you're here. Forget the rest of you. Just
it's like candy.
The rest of you are out.
Like,
me and Victoria are going to play the
game.
We
lost.
Yeah. You're all lost. Victoria
I already
wins.
Lost.
Victoria
yesterday.
Wins. Congratulations to Victoria.
Oh my God, you guys, thank you so much.
All right, I guess we should play the bloody game, even though you guys have terrible ice cream preferences. Yeah, answers that leave you with mint choc chip feelings. They get you 3 points. You get 20 seconds to answer before you hear this. If you ramble, Susie, I will brandish a yellow card and negative 2 points for you. Two yellows gets you the dreaded red. And they're sending off. Or in our case, you have to hover awkwardly in the background in silence until we finish playing. Most points equals belt plus last word. Let's play. We start with Oscar. Round one. Delivery without the box. Amazon wants to deliver your order without a box as it aims to reduce costs. Reach its goals related to its climate impact, writes Sebastian Herrera of The Journal. He notes that Chief Executive Andy Jassy hopes a reduction in packaging will appeal to customers who are put off by the volume of Amazon-branded boxes they receive and discard every week. Just 11% of items Amazon delivers now arrive without extra packaging or what the company calls ships in own container. But Oscar, delivery without the box, what's the point?
I don't love it. I'm sure this is great for Amazon. It'll reduce costs. They're passing them on to the manufacturer. I mean, ethically, I can understand it as well. Although I would argue, aren't we recycling those boxes? Aren't they being used again? Isn't that the point of them? I just think what it boils down to is giving the consumers the choice. It should be up to them. If they want to get rid of the box, let them decide. But if not, please provide privacy for what we order.
Susie.
So I actually think it's very gimmicky. I agree, Oscar, in that really, what's the point? I think before they start thinking about the boxes, they should start thinking about the number of boxes that they're sending us. Yesterday, I made an order for books and it's coming in three different boxes because it's coming 3 different days from different distribution centers. So like they should start with that. And then I also think that it's actually not optional. They're doing it a little bit today, but it defaults. So I was checking after reading the article, it defaults to this weird new way of doing their delivery. And I don't like it. I think that there are a lot of other things we should be doing first.
Blake.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's a bit of a cop out because they aren't doing things like optimizing the number of boxes. They are still really prone to sending, you know, a tiny item in a big box where if they really wanted to, you know, optimize the way that they are using their boxes, they would start there rather than just stripping it in general. I totally agree. I mean, I bought a vinyl record off of Amazon in May of 2020. I was going back in my purchase history after reading this article, and they sent it to my apartment without a box, and it was bent, and it was really disappointing. So, and not only for privacy, but for, you know, for things like that, where they can just, they send a product that needs to be in, need to have a little added protection, but it doesn't. Just a bad experience for the customer.
Everyone's thinking it. What did you buy?
Oh, I bought Freddie Gibbs' record, Freddie Gibbs and Madlib.
You can stay. Well played. All right. So I've got two solutions for you guys here to solve this problem. One I've talked about on the show before a long time ago, and another one I just came up with. So here's the two ways you can get around all the boxes. One, why don't we have different size? So they're called round trip plastic totes. So they're the boxes you get with the like plastic storage bins with a lid that folds together on top. You guys know the ones, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we have different sizes of those? Imagine if you had like 10 different sizes of those, they could fit together really well, or 5 different sizes of those. Companies could rent them the way they do now, or maybe they buy them, but you probably want to rent them. Then you could use them to ship things. Folks could take the thing out of the box. Maybe you could like seal them a certain way. Folks could take the things out of the box, then put them outside the house for pickup, like you do with trash collection. And then they would get delivered back to the facility, and then they would buy them again, and you would do that. You wouldn't have to ever create cardboard or waste cardboard boxes.
I mean, I don't know if you're serious, but it is an operational nightmare when you're talking about it.
Yeah, that would be so expensive.
Yeah.
How come?
They wouldn't be saving money, that's for sure.
The cost of fulfillment, especially when you're like Amazon and you're trying to optimize it and be as fast as possible, is incredibly, incredibly expensive. And in order to that app, basically to have a, you know, a shipping container be able to go from, you know, the home address all the way back to a fulfillment center and making sure that they're not being overly concentrated in specific areas would be really expensive and kind of a logistical nightmare.
The other thing I would add, one of the other things that they're optimizing is also the number of touch points that the package goes through, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is not new, ship direct from vendor. But if the ship direct from vendor is in the box that that vendor has produced instead of the vendor putting it into the Amazon box and then shipping it, that's like saved manpower as well in terms of time, which impacts not obviously the environment, but it impacts Amazon's bottom line. So it's a bit gimmicky, this whole thing.
What I'm describing is basically what we do for 90% of goods around the world. We put everything in shipping containers. We put the thing, if you want to ship something from one country to the other, you put it in a big size container that's standardized and you ship that to another country and then they take it out of the container and then they ship it back. And that's exactly how shipping works.
Right. But it's going from point A to point B.
Yeah. And it's like tablets of stuff, right? So everything is like perfectly aligned, fits perfectly into the container. They don't need to put extra plastic or bubble wrap or anything. It's like all perfectly measured.
Okay.
The pallets, not tablets, pallets.
So you guys are out on that one. Yeah. Fair enough. Thought I'd solve that. They could be collapsible as well, but never mind. I've got another one for you. So you can install delivery bins at homes. They're basically oversized mailboxes. And then you could bring the stuff, take it out of the box that you've brought it in, and as opposed to leaving it on your doorstep without a box, like Oscar was saying, can be horrifying. You could put it in this oversized mailbox and it could be like locked.
So what makes me sad about that option is because in one of the articles, like someone was saying how they could see it working for books, but I think that's the worst idea. Imagine how dirty your book is going to get and all the pages are going to get bent, right? So I think, well, unless the bookmaker puts it in a plastic bag and then we're wasting more resources. So I don't know that there's
I'm not saying put it in a trash bin. This would be just like a clean...
Just think about the like boxes that come to your house today the way they are, how dirty they get. Sometimes it rains and they're like half wet. There's like mud on them. They're gross, some of them.
Who's going to pay for the installation of these giant mailboxes? Because I don't see the people who own my building springing for that. It's hard enough to, you know, get my drain unclogged. They're not going to buy one for the sake of the environment.
I would too. I think that might be a better idea than the first one, Marcus.
Okay,
but yeah, I have to think that one through a bit.
You have to shoot the other one down.
There's some potential, a little bit of potential there.
Yeah. Well, also, like most Amazon products are below 5 pounds in weight. So we're not delivering just couches. I thought most things would fit. It's basically just like Amazon lockers have now, but at home. It's the same concept. Mm-hmm. All right, fine. Yeah. You guys are frightfully pessimistic, just trying to save the planet.
The thing is, it's like you have to find ways to save the planet.
You guys live in your cardboard filled world where it's wasted all the time.
I recycle.
Do you?
Same.
Absolutely.
But you can only recycle so much because sometimes boxes, like they don't get put in the right recycling thing, or sometimes if they get dirty, then they won't be able to recycle. And if you recycle, that still uses up energy and is still more wasteful
than not.
Yeah. All right. Trying to save the world.
I thought you were going with the like reversible, because some of them are doing it, like the reversible bags where on the end other, like when you open the bag and you turn it around, you can put your item back to ship it back if you were trying to return it. Or like the SodaStream boxes, you rip off their my address label and it's their address label. And then I send the cans back to them, the canisters. And so like there are definitely ways that we can help save the environment. It just has to be really easy for the customer, because as we know from research, they'll say one thing, but then when you have to pay for it, it's a whole different thing, unless it's legislation.
This is also how groceries get delivered, at least in the UK. So if Waitrose comes to your door, it's a supermarket, they bring all the items in a plastic crate and they bring them to your door. You take the crate, you put it in your house, you take the things out, you give them the crate back. Now, admittedly, you have to be there for that. So you could argue that that's a problem, but they don't have cardboard or plastic bags. They bring your items loose in a green crate. This is exactly the crate I described, and they hand it to you and you take them out. So that is happening in some form or fashion, at least in
the UK. And they wait for you to unload the box and then they take the box back?
Yep. Yeah, it just takes like a minute.
Less margin conscious.
And there are just fewer people doing it. I mean, that the demand for delivery in that sense is already strained for a lot of grocery companies, that if you made that the fulfillment method for everything, it just wouldn't be able to keep up.
Negative 10 for everyone. Bunch of pessimists.
Negative 10 for bad ideas, Marcus.
What is unbelievable. These are two great ideas. I'm getting nothing from you guys.
I'm listening because I'm liking some of what I'm hearing.
Thank you, Oscar. Yeah. You're just trying to get points back. It's not happening. Round two. What's happening on TikTok Live? Caroline Mims Nice of The Atlantic writes that the live streaming section is a non-stop online carnival. TikTok Live, that is. Weird, flashy, maximalist, and messy. And big business, with folks estimating that users are spending billions of dollars there. Mia Sato of The Verge notes that TikTok will host a music contest, think The Voice, called Gimme the Mic, that will be held on TikTok live streams and will incorporate live voting from fans. The winner of the US competition gets 50,000 diamonds. No one knows what the hell that means. TikTok's in-app currency is what diamonds are, but they can't be exchanged for real money. We just don't know how much real money. One estimate suggests $2,500. But Susie, what's happening on TikTok live? What's the point?
So I think TikTok is going for world domination in every industry possible and is now moving into music. I think that they are doing a very good job at copying what others are doing and then innovating on that and moving forward. So for example, this competition sounds a little bit like a Eurovision style online where it's live voting. That's immediate gratification for their viewers. And yes, it's not a lot of money potentially for some folks, the $2,000, but imagine the number of people that are watching you and following you and that you can monetize on for future use.
Like,
yeah, I think some of like this, the odd behavior that we're seeing on live streaming is definitely, it's not, you know, new to TikTok, or I guess it's new to TikTok, but not new to social media. People have been doing weird stuff on streams on Twitch and YouTube for a while. But, you know, I think the takeaway here is that for TikTok, they've been trying to get like the live streaming component off the ground for a while. And this notion of donating, you know, some form of, you know, money to the creators could be, you know, a stepping stone to live shopping, which is sort of the, you know, this gold mine that people, that all these platforms have been looking for years. So even though it seems a little, it's very much in its infancy right now, you know, it could be something to really keep a close eye on for the future.
Oscar?
I think it's a brilliant idea. As Susie and Blake said, you know,
this
TikTok's
is a brilliant idea. I'm trying to save the planet. And this is a brilliant idea.
It is. Blake and Susie said TikTok's trying to figure out what translates well outside of China in terms of live streaming. And I think live entertainment like this is the way to go. I looked into this. When American Idol, The Voice, and Masked Singer are all on at the same time, they can combine to upwards of 15 million viewers in the U.S. So people love live singing competitions, live entertainment like this. And so it feels like the right idea for them.
At the halfway point, Susie well out in front with 6, Oscar with 3, Blake with a measly 2.
Guys, that never happened.
It doesn't.
3?
We moved. Yeah, that's right. I said it. We moved to round 3. We start with Blake for fast fashion, looking to repairs. Fast fashion aims to mend its image with repairs, writes Trevor Moss of the Wall Street Journal. He notes that brands are encouraging shoppers to patch up their old clothes instead of throwing them out as they face growing environmental scrutiny. Mr. Moss points to a number of examples. Zara this year is launching nationwide repair services in several of its largest markets. Uniqlo is adding repair studios to a number of stores. And H&M-owned COS is working with a startup to help customers fix damaged dresses and jackets. But Blake, fast fashion looking to repairs, what's the point?
I guess the point here is that it's really just going to be sort of PR for these fast fashion companies unless people decide that they really want to use it. But I think that the consumer appeal for fast fashion is really to get the latest season styles. And that's not really conducive to, you know, sort of patching up what was in trend a season ago. So I don't really think that consumers who are into fast fashion for those reasons are going to be incentivized to use these services very much.
Oscar.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical. I think it's primarily a marketing ploy. I mean, the fast fashion brands are being forced to do something here. I just think, you know, most people won't be using the services. There was one quote on the price there. Are you really going to pay $13 to, you know, mend a hole in a shirt that costs you, you know, 25 or 30? I don't think so. Plus, you know, clothes, it's not just about a hole. You know, the colors fade and the textiles are stretched out and things just get old. So I think it's mainly that. I would highlight more the fact that these programs also allow for products to be donated and potentially even sold for a small price. So I think that's more of what consumers will be using, not getting anything fixed for an added price.
Susie.
Just in general, we're hearing a lot of buzz around this. Some of it is legislation driven. Some of it is the UN trying to get people on the same page around the world. I think it's interesting that Europe is ahead of us here in the US. It is something that they've been doing for a long time. It's something that a lot of brands have been doing for a long time, you know, especially the higher end brands, because why would you spend a lot of money on something and not get it fixed? Here, like Oscar is noting, it's a quality issue, right? They are trying to do some cool things. Like I thought the patches that they're trying to sell on H&M to try and do your own with tutorials was kind of clever. Although my mom put patches on our jeans when we were kids. So like, again, it's a revival of what we were already doing. And I thought it was interesting because it is an operational nightmare, right? This idea that they are going to be able to scale on their own, I think is slim to none. So it's interesting that there is a company that thought about this in 2019 called The Seam, and they're partnering with that.
All right, folks, a very good round. We moved to round four, double points round four. Susie's still out in front, but by less. She's got 8, Oscar on 6, and Blake with 5. Double points round four, so still all to play for. We're talking about the future of website design. Site design shakeups are helping retail brands increase conversion, decrease return rates, and build lasting, fruitful relationships with their most loyal customers, writes Rebecca Dzinski of Inc. She notes a few ways businesses are transforming e-commerce, from gamification and quizzes that let brands ask questions and learn about customers in a way that's baked into the flow of the experience, to image recognition technology that uses AI to attribute more accurate customer-centric keywords to products at scale. But Oscar, the future of website design, what's the point?
I do think that retailers sometimes focus too much of their budget and energy on apps only. And I think that there are many retailers that could improve their web experience. A few come to mind, but I'll just name one. Amazon. Amazon's webpage is horrible. I'm sorry, Amazon. Love you, but sorry, it really is. So I think this makes a lot of sense. And there's so many great ideas out there. But, you know, I think of Nike actually as one brand that does a good job. And what do they do? High level of personalization, loyalty programs, and just easier filtering to see sort of products and sizes and what's sold out and what isn't. So there's a ton that can be done. And I think many need to focus their energy on that.
Susie.
So this future of site design article was not futuristic in any way, shape, or form. It was all buzz and nothing new. And the biggest thing I learned, which is something we're studying for, so as Blake knows, I've been keeping a closer eye on this, the number of touch points that someone goes through before they make a purchase, according to one of the people in the articles, is 7 to 8, which I thought was kind of a lot. But at the same time, we were just talking about buying a flight, which is a very expensive thing. And for some, it's only 4 things, right? So 7 to 8 for like a pair of jeans seems like a lot of touch points. But as Oscar said, you need to have an easy to use, convenient with improved search, like all of this easy, fast loading pages, user generated content. Nothing was new. It's obvious that all that stuff leads to better conversion.
Blake.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the premise that brands and retailers should focus on the website, the desktop website, is very valid. But a lot of the examples that the article put forth were, like Susie said, very gimmicky, and that it just ease of use and just having a customer interface that's easy to find the items that you want, that's easy to filter and search. These are things that are very sort of, you know, have been table stakes for a long time, but it's something that most people fail at. So I think that the shiny penny of having like integrated user-generated content to sort of keep people within your ecosystem is quite a pipe dream for many brands and retailers that just don't have the basics down correctly.
All right, folks, end of the game. Let's count the points.
Drum roll.
A drum roll. You know how it goes. Who won? Oh, sound effects. Random sound effects. Stop. Okay, we're back. A drum roll. Who could it be?
I didn't get that.
Susie! Round of applause for Susie.
No.
The crowd goes.
Oh my gosh,
enough.
I'm blushing.
Susie wins, 12 points. Oscar, 10. Blake,
well done. Well,
let's
done.
Just say less. All right, Susie, congratulations. You get the championship belt and, of course, the last word.
I'm so excited. Actually, my last word is a question. I would like our listeners to write to us, and then Marcus, I would like to hear the answers, as to how many websites do you go to before you purchase an international flight? That is
Susie
my question.
Susie spent 6 months booking her most recent vacation. Is
basically.
Why we're talking about
I had
this.
Everybody.
6 months is too long.
Yeah. Everybody in my life was like, did you book it? Did you book it? No, I'm not done researching it. Can you imagine what that means for insider intelligence research? Can you imagine how thoughtful and how we go all out and find the right information to help you run your business?
No one else does that. It's just Susie.
I took like 2 hours to decide on a restaurant the other day
for
upcoming
on,
travel
people.
As well. So yeah,
just
I
walk
agree
around,
with you,
pick one.
It says something about our research here.
So something about you two.
Thinkers.
That's what it says something about. Don't drag me and Blake down with you. Go on, Blake. You have something to add?
I mean, I'll book a flight quickly so I can spend the time picking the food. I'm way more inclined to, you know, overthink restaurant choices on a vacation than I am on a flight. But
that's
just
so interesting because, like, I go and then I'm like, oh, I wonder where people are going. I'm going to go where the restaurant looks busy. And
but
then
wait,
that's it.
But Blake, you were saying picking a restaurant on the vacation.
Yeah, on a
Oscar means just in life, don't you, Oscar? Is that what you're getting at?
No. That was for vacation.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, nice
liar.
Upcoming trip. Yeah, making sure I pick the right place.
Wait, but you guys book your restaurants ahead of time? Like, see,
oh
this
my, you
is
gotta do, you got to do the research. Yeah.
Wow. Oh, that's where the research goes.
I mean, there are a few places, like, you know, like Paris, I feel like you could kind of just walk in anywhere. But most of the time, even in places like Italy, if you're, you know, a little laissez-faire about it and just kind of looking around, like, you can get a bad meal. And you only have so many meals on vacation, so you want them all to be good. A bad meal at home is not great, but a bad meal on vacation, that's devastating.
I'm learning a lot about you guys.
Wait, so do you ever go to this? Like, I sometimes go to the same restaurant twice if I thought it was really
good. Yes, I'll do that. Ooh. On the last night of vacation, sometimes you double back. You go to the one that you like the best.
Love that.
Yeah.
Yep.
You guys are such tourists. I love
it. Maybe it just depends on how long you're there for.
Would never do that. reservations, guys, you know, you gotta contact the restaurant weeks in advance.
Oh my
you
God.
Get your name
I
on
I think
there.
Oscar is oh, going to much. These Michelin-starred restaurants. That's why.
I told you he's
I like,
changed.
I like
he's
my
fancy
vegetables
now.
Tweezered, you know, on my plate.
Yeah. You're the worst so person.
That makes sense.
All right, let's move on. Time now for dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's start with Blake. Susie won. She's supposed to go first. Sorry. Sorry, Blake.
No, no problem.
Go on, Susie. We have to start with you.
So I was trying to find the statistic around how many websites do people go to, and I couldn't find
it. Oh,
God,
moving on. Blake, what you got?
So I wanted to ask you, because Marcus and I talked about this yesterday.
At length.
Do you all believe that time is money? And do you know who said that first-ish? Who we believe said it first?
Was it me?
No,
Benjamin Franklin.
No idea. Benjamin Franklin.
Typical.
Yeah, in his
of course, yeah.
advice to a Typical. Young tradesman. And it's become an inspiration for a lot of people. But the question is, what does that mean to you? And what are the different resources that you are pitting against time? So my question is, from a blog post, so not at all rooted in any research, someone wrote about five things that are more valuable than money. And it made me laugh the list, so I wanted to share it with you. Can you think about what's the number one thing that's more valuable than money?
Love.
Time. Okay, yeah. Time. Number two.
You guys are probably going to say peanut butter.
Friendship.
Ugh.
Three.
Okay. Yuck.
Physical well-being. Again, this is according to one person. So listeners, if you are going to write in, tell us too what you think is more valuable than money.
Mm-hmm.
Four.
Mm-hmm.
Wisdom And five, this one's my favorite.
God, here we go.
Romantic love.
Oh, wow.
None of them are more valuable. For
I don't know about that one.
It's too dark, Marcus. It's too dark.
Or wisdom.
I will leave you with, for global tourism, 1 in 10 jobs are in tourism around the world, and it is 10% of our economy, global economy.
Very nice. Very good indeed. Blake, you're up.
I've been watching a lot of James Bond movies recently, and a lot of James Bond's, most specifically Daniel Craig, they tend to mumble a lot. So I've been watching them with the subtitles on, and I even though it's, you know, in English, I found at the same time this YouGov survey that just came out about how 38% of U.S. adults said that they most frequently watch TV with the subtitles on, even in a language that they know. Interesting enough, you'd think that older people would be more inclined to do this because, you know, as you get old, the hearing gets worse and you can't, you know, it's harder to understand things going on TV. But actually, no, 63% of 18 to 29-year-olds typically watch TV with subtitles on, whereas just 30% of those 65 and older do so.
I actually happened to see that yesterday, that research. I thought it was fascinating how high it was, and it was still pretty high across all the generations, but yeah, the young people over-indexing. But I thought the reasons why was that understanding what they're saying better comprehension and accents.
Yeah.
That's why I had it on for Peaky Blinders, and Birmingham, the town where that shot is like an hour away from where I grew up, couldn't understand the word. But yeah, I thought that was fascinating as well. Do you guys? Subtitles?
It depends. Yes. I mean, if I need to, yeah, then yeah. I do find always, a lot of movies where the actors mumble, and it's better to just have the
music's really
loud
sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every score stays
in film. It's part of the entertainment for me. I don't know. I just, it's nice to lean into it sometimes. It's good to have it. You know, why not?
Susie?
No.
Okay, moving on.
I think it's an age thing. I think it's a habit and age thing. Like when my nieces come, they turn it on, but when they leave, I turn it back off.
It's because of social media, I guess, right? They're used to seeing them on social media.
I don't know, or maybe like they're multitasking. But that's even harder to multitask and read. I'm not sure why they do it.
Hmm.
Outside of what you guys just said.
Yeah.
Which you don't need for the Kardashians.
Oscar, maybe. Oscar, you're up.
Well, mine's kind of a dinner party / just a plug for something I wanted to talk about. So it's going to be fun. I don't know if you guys know, but the Women's World Cup is happening.
Oh, yes, I do, sir.
You do.
Guess who's in the final?
I know. That's what we need to
England
talk about
against
here.
Spain. Bring it on,
it's
Oscar.
Spain versus England on Sunday at 6 o'clock in the morning here on the Eastern Coast. So please watch. Please support the game.
Support England. You know, because it's, support the game.
We'll see about that. We'll see about that. But because it's a dinner party, I mean, I want to throw a couple of facts in there. I mean, does anyone know what rendition this is? How many Women's World Cups we've had?
How many men's one have there been?
This is nine?
It's nine. Men's, I'm not quite sure, but more than double that probably. It's been going on since the 30s.
Yeah.
So nine, the first one was in 1991, in the 90s. So it's very, very recent. It's the first tournament that has 32 teams, so the same amount as the men's tournament for the first time ever.
And they're just about to up their capacity,
that's
right,
true.
To 48?
They're going to go up to 48 in the next, in 2026, I believe. So exactly. Yeah. Then it'll be off again, but I'm sure the Women's World Cup will gain more and more teams as more teams play the game. Mm-hmm. Do we know how many countries have won both men's and women's World Cups?
Eight.
I guess. Eight. That's a big number. No, it's one country. Germany.
I thought you meant as in like count the teams that have won the men's, count the teams that have won the women's. You mean both?
No, in terms of both.
Sorry.
Yeah, both.
No, okay, yeah, that eight's a stupid guess. Yeah, okay.
I was a little confused by that one. But yes, it's only Germany. Germany has won both the women's and the men's World Cup. But as you were saying, Marcus, this Sunday, Spain or England will be crowned the winner.
England.
Whoever wins will be, we'll see, will be the second country to have won both the men's and the women's World Cup. So it'll be on Fox, 6 a.m. I have no more stats there, but as I said, it's a bit of a plug. So
very
really,
nice.
Really excited about the final. It was a great tournament.
Yeah. Great one. 2 billion people around the world tuning into the Women's World Cup. So be one of them. It's been fantastic. Very nice. All right, folks, I've got one for you real quick. Talking about theme parks, amusement parks, same thing. This is from the TEA, the Themed Entertainment Association, and AECOM 2022 Theme Index and Museum Index, the Global Attractions Attendance Report. That's where this information is from. Five facts for you about theme parks. So last year, 2022, nearly 200 million folks attended the top 25 amusement or theme parks around the world. That's nearly 80% of pre-pandemic 2019 levels. Number two, can you guys guess the number one theme park in the world by attendance?
Yes, Canada's Wonderland.
Absolutely not.
I forget the name. Disney's... What,
I think it's Disney Paris.
It might be Tokyo.
No, it's... Tokyo's up there. So number five, Universal's Islands of Adventure, Florida, 11 million. Tokyo Disneyland is 12 million. Then it's Universal Studios Japan, 12.5. Disneyland Park in California is 17 million. And Magic Kingdom at Walt Disney Florida, 17 million is number one. Just
How
over
did
17
Canada's
million.
Wonderland not make it on that list?
It wasn't even close. Point number three, Disney resorts account for 8 of the top 10 amusement or theme parks in the world by attendance. Florida, number four, Florida accounts for 6 of the top 12 parks and 1/3 of the top 25 visits worldwide, just the state of Florida. And if you look at just the US or just North America, 2022 attendance at the top 20 North American amusement and theme parks was 140 million. That's nearly 90% of pre-pandemic levels. Water park attendance in North America, over 12 million a year, was 80% of pre-pandemic levels. Disney's Typhoon Lagoon in Florida topped the list.
I've never been to any of these. Can you believe that?
Really?
Terrible childhood. Yeah, no. I was not
Oscar's parents, if you're listening. So sorry he said that. What a terrible child. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Oscar.
Thank you for having me, Marcus.
Of course, sir. Thank you to Susie.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. Thank you to Blake.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay.
Oh, me too. I want something different to say. What can I say?
You can say, Marcus, that was a brilliant job hosting. No one ever thanks the host. Like, oh, great job hosting, Marcus. You're really well. You're really good at your
That's
job.
That's true. Never heard of that one.
Yeah.
Marcus, thanks for having me.
Whatever. Moving
doing
on. It's not
such
the same.
A good job.
I told you to say it. Congratulations, though, Susie. You did win the game of the week. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can head to Instagram at behindthenumbers_podcast for photos of what we look like. We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.
Wait, Oscar, do you get your laundry sent out? Oh,
yes.
Wow, big flex.
Yes.
Wow.
Sent out and
I know. You
I
see
know.
That little humble brag.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, guys. My
no
laundry just got delivered, so I don't want to brag.
I also have someone else in the house picking it up.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Now it's my girlfriend had to get it, but seriously, they were going wild on the bell. Sorry about that.
You'll see a hand just come into the screen.
Good
to
go.
Yeah. Oh my God, you're giving Paul Verna a run for his money with his butler.
I have no other choice, guys. I can't do my
you've
own,
changed,
my own laundry
Oscar.
Here.
You've
I
changed.
I swear.